This podcast is brought to you with support from The Big Idea, New Zealand's online hub for creative people. The Big Idea aims to support talented, innovative individuals and organisations and advocates for creativity as an essential ingredient in the cultural and economic wealth of New Zealand. Their website is thebigidea.nz. This episode is also brought to you by We Are Braves, a photography company focusing on creating artistic, beautiful images that'll boost your self-esteem and celebrate the real you. We Are Braves offers portrait, boudoir, and body art packages, and the team will work closely with you to bring your vision to life. A great idea for a gift for your loved one or simply a gift for yourself. Visit wearebraves.co.nz to find out more. Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the podcast, the only podcast you need. I haven't said it like that for a while.
No, you haven't.
I was trying to get that to catch on as our thing, but it didn't seem to catch on.
The only podcast you'll ever need. Tell us a little bit about today's guest.
Well, I
don't even know who it is. Who is he?
Today's guest is Mikey Carpenter. Now, Mikey is one of these people who has multiple careers in a way. He's been in the public eye for a number of different reasons, hasn't he? He's been, what was the name of his character on What Now?
Well, again? He was in the public eye, but he wasn't really, because people didn't really know who was under that hat. He was props boy.
That's right, yes, yeah. Yes. But yes, he was unknown in the public eye, a very unusual place to be.
Mm.
And then he was a member of AutoZam,
mm-hmm.
And he's also got quite a successful production company, does like stuff in video and post-production. And mm-hmm. He's also now managing the up-and-coming band LA.
Right.
And you've known him for a long time, right? Because he's from your gang, isn't
yeah.
he? From your neighbourhood.
He's from Christchurch, yeah. Yep. I've known Mikey for yeah. a long time. And
From the Badlands. Were you by skinheads together?
No. Not everyone in Christchurch is a skinhead, man.
Really? There's a couple spares, a couple exceptions.
You'll offend all of our Christchurch listener.
That's not my problem. all of our Christchurch listener. I just realised what you said. That was good.
Thank you. I've known Mikey from the way back in the day down there. I think.
Did you play in bands together or anything like that?
No, I don't even think. I mean, of all the years that I've known and hung out with him, I don't think we've ever played a note of music together. I mean, all of them toured with us on a summer tour once, but never have we been in the same, area making noise at the same time.
Don't you mean you guys toured with AutoZam?
What's the difference? No, they supported us, actually, motherfucker. I think that's what you were trying to get at.
Yeah, just twisting the knife a little bit,
and that was probably 10 years ago now, actually. Yeah, almost exactly right. 10 years ago. On the eve of the financial crisis that brought the, capitalism to its knees. And
I hadn't actually thought about the fact that that was 10 years ago. Isn't that amazing?
Mm.
Did you feel the effects of the recession yourself in any way?
It's hard to say. I think so. I mean, the fact that tour failed was put down to the recession. That might have been that might have been us placating ourselves a little bit. But I think so. But that was about the time that I had just started doing music full time, like nothing else but music. Right. And yeah, they were the poorest part of the poorest section of my life was those 10 years that followed, or the 5 years that followed that. So probably. Probably. And I guess there were less people buying music, more people stealing because there was no money around.
Yeah.
There was less corporate money for gigs, probably.
Right.
These are just all guesses, I think, wild guesses, but it wasn't a good time to be a musician.
Yeah, it was interesting for me. Like, I noticed that, speaking very vaguely, my business dropped by about a third. My turnover dropped by about a third.
Right, so people not like hiring you for gigs?
Just everything across the board, it just seemed to go away. Venues were closing, gigs were getting cancelled. Everyone was tightening their pockets up. People didn't want to spend money, which is sort of shooting themselves in the foot because we really had to spend money to keep everything going. But everyone froze and panicked and industries just collapsed all around us. But it was an interesting time for me because I was about three years into running my business and being full time working for myself and so on, and mm-hmm. everyone had talked about my decision to do that as if it was either a really bad idea, really crazy, really risky,
or it was really bold and I was to be commended because I was obviously very brave and whatever. And neither of those things resonated with me. I thought, what are you talking about, you know?
Yeah.
But their idea was that if you didn't have the regular day job and the comfort and security of a 9-to-5, then you're putting everything on the line.
Mm.
And so then this happened and I'm like, well, who's got the, you know, who's in the most risky, most vulnerable position here? You know, because my business has dropped by a third, but I'm not going to fire myself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to pay myself a lot less and I'm just going to, you know, really think strategically and make plans and whatever. But I'm still employed.
Mm.
And people who had these comfortable, secure jobs weren't employed anymore, you know?
Yeah, right. And you know, apparently we're on the dawn of an even worse crisis now.
Mm.
You know, the way that banks, and look, this is not financial advice, by the way, anybody, or anything like that. I'm talking out of a hole in my ass. But, you know, banks, one of the ways that they ease pressure during a recession is to lower interest rates.
Right.
But there is no room to move now. There's no interest rate lowering to happen that can happen, really.
Hmm.
And the printing of money, the quantitative easing that happened last time round, you know, flooded the market with printed money. They can't really do that again either. So
that's right. Yeah,
this one's going to be longer, deeper, and probably more destructive. And it's not very far away. They're saying 2 years.
Exactly. And I don't. I mean, I'm not really inside that conversation. I don't have much to offer in regards to, you know, anything.
Anything at all
profound on that subject. Anything at all, really. But I do think some of these big changes are challenging the way that we have default opinions on how life should work. That we mm-hmm. think, you know, you're supposed to follow a certain route in life, and once you get your degree and once you buy your house and whatever, then everything's going to be fine. But the world's changing, you know. And I think I'm not saying you shouldn't do any of those things. And I'm not saying there's anything particular you should do. I think you should just think about it.
Yeah.
You know, just weigh up your options. Because for me, it wasn't the right move to do a couple of those things. And I think I ended up being safer.
Right.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what my point was, but
join a commune. I think that's where you're getting it.
Yeah, yeah. But the other thing it made me do was that when I was at the really worst part with my business, it made me think about how to strategize. I had a little bit of money left and I had a bit of time before I was going to run out of money. So I had to think about what I was going to do with that to reinvest to try and build things up.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing it made me do was really look at the business, analyze the business and go, where am I wasting money? Where am I wasting time? How can I improve things? So I was able to, you know, tighten up a lot of the infrastructure within the business. I was able to reinforce a lot of the branding. And basically, once the economy started to right itself, I came out the other end with a much stronger business and went on to become a lot more successful than I'd been just before the recession.
Right.
It's interesting.
Okay.
There's something about burning the... What's that thing about burning the bush so you can grow new bush can grow out of the ashes or whatever the fuck that is. It's late and I'm tired.
I think you've mixed your metaphors. I don't know. Is it something about a phoenix or a talking bush or?
Oh, they burn off some of the land and then new growth can come through or something to that effect. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a fucking farmer.
Nor are you a philosopher.
No, never claimed to be. Thank Jesus.
Thank you, Jesus. You're not even religious. So what did you and Mikey talk about? Or should we listen to the podcast to find out?
You should listen to find out. I think we covered a hell of a lot. He's had a busy career. And I had actually quite a long list of questions because I knew that he had a lot crammed into his career and I wanted to get through certain things. And we actually managed to tick them all off, which was brilliant.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, it's a great one. He's a great dude and it was a good time talking to him.
Awesome. Well, let's have a listen. It'll be my first time.
Cool.
Now let's do this!
Strangely, we haven't had many guitar players on the
really?
Show. We've had a few, but yeah. We've mostly had drummers and bass players, and we've had a relatively high number of saxophonists. But
it's because drummers and bass players never get to say anything ever.
So they jump right? at the chance.
Yeah, it's like offer them anything other than playing drums. They're like,
right.
Yeah, gives a hoon.
So it's quite cool. Like when you're coming over, I'm thinking guitar player and singer. That's what I do.
Oh, God.
We can talk shop.
I wouldn't call myself either of those anymore.
No?
Sweet as.
But out of the game?
Oh, I haven't played... I haven't sung anything or played guitar for ages.
Right.
It's just because But I also get to still go and, like, obviously hang out with the boys and go on tour. So I just do that and then My biggest joy at the moment is sound checking the drums.
Right.
On tour. So Jaden can stand out the front and be like, oh yeah, that sounds mean.
Oh, you mean actually playing the drums?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He can sound check it. Right.
I sit at the drum kit while they're setting up, just waiting to be able to hit the kick, hit the snare, and then play four on the floor and be like, yep, mean.
Have you always had that fascination with the drum? Because I have. Like, I was always a guitar player that would rather be a drummer.
Oh man, I think any guitar player thinks he can drum.
Oh yeah.
It's just part of the thing.
It's funny, exactly.
I can play a pretty solid four on the floor.
Right.
But I wouldn't go beyond that.
Well, why are most guitar players so bad at listening to the drummer then?
Most drummers are dicks. Not you though, Bobby.
Yeah.
You're one of the good guys.
So did you have a classic intro to playing and something, you know, was it around the age of 12 or something you started writing songs or something?
It was... So my brother played guitar first.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all like Rockwest. Like, got to high school, he was in a Rockwest band, and I was like, man, that looks choice.
Yeah.
And then, so he taught me a few chords. And then from there, I got a guitar tutor who kind of changed my life. I was with him for like 6 years.
Were you in Auckland or where'd you grow up?
Christchurch.
Christchurch, okay.
Yeah, this is in Christchurch.
Yeah.
So I was just working at Rock Shop part-time, and there was this dude there, his name was Nigel.
Yeah.
And he was a monster guitar player, like could shred, like you name it, like you just watch him play, you'd be like, man, that dude is amazing.
Right.
So I was like, oh, can I have some guitar lessons? And then basically he took me under his wing for like 5 or 6 years.
So he wasn't actually a tutor?
No,
like he just tutored you.
Yeah, he's just a dude who worked at the Rock Shop.
Cool.
And then we became mates and he taught me, and that's where my guitar playing came from.
And what age were you? So you're already working, did you say?
Yeah, I was probably didn't really start. I probably did my lessons from like 14 to 19 kind of thing, through high school.
Yeah.
But I was working at the Rock Shop part time, like on a Saturday morning, you know? Like
right.
Hanging cables up and counting picks.
Yeah.
As you do, like 60
counting picks.
60 cents an hour, whatever it was back then.
Yeah, I think it's still the same, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. So that's where I learned guitar, and then just from there, just through Rockwest, obviously been in bands, and you know.
And who were your guys that you looked up? Who were the guitar players you looked up to at the time?
Oh, I loved, like, I was a big Satriani and Vi fan.
Really?
At the start, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
right. I wouldn't have picked that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I loved to shred. I loved to like hoon around the fretboard when I was younger.
Yeah.
Satriani, Vi. Then from there, like obviously got into some pretty deep GNR slash.
Right, yep. That was the era though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't Tom Morello
quite know what
as well.
Year we're talking about. But
well, it's just the span of all those, I guess, that late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Tom Morello, like when Rage Against the Machine came out, I was like, who's this dude?
Right.
Like just all, you know, people playing riffs, you know?
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Big guitar, filthy riffs.
And so we're talking when you were taking guitar lessons, what, late 80s, early 90s or something?
I
don't actually know how old you are.
I'm 40.
So I'm sort of guessing. Oh,
I'm 40, so that means...
Oh, so later then?
Yeah, it was like, I started playing guitar when I was like in 1992, whatever
it
was.
Oh, okay, right.
You know? So through there. So, you know, also Nirvana and like Pearl Jam and all of that, you know.
That's just a year after I started playing.
Right, yeah.
91, so it was just like Guns N' Roses was the biggest band in the world at the time.
Yeah, totally, and then Pearl Jam came along.
Yeah.
And, you know, just some good guitar riffs on that. So that was, guitaring for me was like, yeah, just plug into a little amp, drop down a D, play some riffs, do some scales, have a long hair and an undercut.
It was quite weird though, wasn't it? Like, starting at about that time where there was the end of the 80s thing and then grunge was a game changer.
Yep.
Pearl Jam changed everything. It made it sort of irrelevant to listen to the other stuff again.
Yeah.
But then... Only a few years later, it seemed like guitar playing almost went out of fashion. At least guitar solos went out of fashion.
Totally, yeah.
Like, yeah, it was kind of like we're all homeless for a while.
Well, even now, like if you hear a guitar solo now, you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like that's impressive.
Well, a guitar solo never gets on the radio, does it?
No, not at all.
With the odd exception, I guess. But.
Yeah, but you're right, though. It just slowly disappeared. Like
the
art of playing rock guitar just disappeared from mainstream. I mean, Oasis, I guess, for me was a big one as well, which kind of brought solos back, like melodic solos.
Yeah.
They
took a lot of shit, hey, that band. But they were a good band.
They wrote some great songs. Yeah. They wrote some shit songs, but they wrote some great songs.
Yeah.
And they kept it real simple. And Noel Gallagher's a real, you know, basically a very simple guitarist, but has got a real good ear for melody. So.
But it's clever writing. It's hooky as fuck.
Totally. You know? I mean, they stole loads of shit from other people.
Yeah.
You know, that's all right.
But, like, I never understand that accusation because everyone steals from everyone, you know.
I know.
And it's like, as soon as something is... I don't know. It's like Oasis were really obviously influenced by the Beatles.
Yeah.
And it's like, what, is that a bad thing? Like, what's the problem? You know, yeah. every rock band sounds the same. So what's the complaint?
Yeah. No, it's true. And yeah. Oasis stole from themselves. You know, they released the same song multiple times with different melodies.
Like, I could name many bands that have done that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, I guess, yeah, that was kind of the last, I guess, I remember of like, you know, guitar solos. And that was like when Oasis kind of did their thing, but I can't think of anyone since where I've, you know, where I've gone, man, this is a really good guitar band that's come back out.
Right. Really? No one?
Muse.
Yep.
For sure. But again, you wouldn't say like, you know.
It's a type of playing, isn't it?
It's you know, it's big dirty riffs, which is great, which I love.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, if I was to put on some guitar music, I wouldn't be putting on anyone in the last 10 years, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I know
for
what you
me,
mean.
Personally,
like,
you know.
Like, I was never really a blues person, so all that stuff sort of went past me. With the odd exception, like, I love Gary Clark Jr., but I love him because he's not just playing straight blues. He's sort of mixing it with hip-hop, and and I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
And I think Derek Trucks is amazing.
See, these are all people that I should probably know about,
right,
which I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I think I'm just stuck in 96 to 2002. Which is fine with me.
At least you can admit it.
Yeah. I know what I like, you know? Yeah.
Were you, had you made a decision back then that you wanted to pursue music? Or were you sort of, did you, you know, I mean, for me it was like, I was 12 years old and like, this is my life. You know?
100%, yeah. Yeah. All through school it was like, that's all I cared about. And I didn't want to do anything else other than play in a band and hang out with my bandmates and travel around with my band. And I did that, I literally did that from the age of like 15 to, you know, 32 or 33.
Right.
You know, so.
Is that right?
Yeah. Just
so,
that whole time.
I don't really know the history of AutoZam, but does AutoZam sort of originate at that time?
So AutoZam started in 2002, probably. Yeah. So yeah, that went for like 12 years.
But were they the same guys that you were playing with when you were 15 or 16?
Nah, that was different. That was like my high school band, Rock West band, and that was through Christchurch. And then we moved to Wellington, me and my mate Ricky, who played drums.
Yeah.
We moved to Welly, and then, that band kind of split up. And then, you know, he went and started the Accelerants, which is another band, and I started AutoZam, and then we went from there.
What's the deal with Christchurch? Because I think really since meeting Bobby and Clint and those guys, it never occurred to me until then how many known artists have come out of Christchurch.
I think
it's insane.
I think there's a real good, well, back then there was a really good, a lot of schools were really strong in music and sport.
Right.
Like, that was Christchurch. It was like, you had amazing rugby and amazing bands, and like Christchurch was, you know, won a few rock. Like, it was just like a good, there was good vibes down there for like schools against schools for music and all that stuff. I feel like a lot of musicians came out of there. Probably similar to what happened to Nelson in the last few years, where you're starting to see lots of musos coming out of Nelson.
So you're saying that the schools were supportive?
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah, right. Like, music departments, and it was just a really good community of musicians.
Yeah.
Playing through high school back then. And I think people like Glenn and Pete from Rock West, who were teaching down there at the time, like, they were creating this environment of students and putting bands together and all of this stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, I remember, because I went to the same school as like, so like Kiro and all those guys, you know, for the first year they were still at my school, then they all left. But I just remember getting to high school and just being like, these guys are rock stars, you know, like they're in seventh form and, you know, they are. It's the closest thing you're going to be to having someone to look up to musically.
Yeah, right.
At your school.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's not like outside of school bands that you hear on the radio. It's like you're looking up to people within your school and going, I can't wait to, you know, come through that system.
Yeah, it makes sense. It challenges a view that I've held on to for a long time, that music has no place in schools. You know, I've always had that idea that putting music in the curriculum is sort of pointless, because music is its own journey. It's a personal journey.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But you're, I mean, not you, but, you know, that really challenges that. And not many good musicians came out of my school. And yet when you hear about the schools in Auckland that were very supportive, lots of great musicians came out of those schools. So maybe I'm just completely wrong.
Well, I think it also comes down to your teacher, right? Like, we just had an amazing music teacher for the whole time.
Right.
And she was just a full-blown hippie muso who did not care about whether you knew how to read music. She was like, put you in a band, play some songs.
Right.
Play.
Yeah.
Like, I can't read a single note of music, you know?
It's not uncommon.
Yeah. So I guess, I guess think back then, like for our school, it was like our music teacher was great. So we got a lot of great musicians
that
came out of our school.
Right.
You know, and when she left, like, you know, it kind of stopped.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a great attitude to demystify music.
Yeah.
For, you know, so just say, just do it rather than elevate it, you know?
Yep.
I think there's a lot of people out there, and I meet a lot of them, who have decided somewhere in the past, especially because of someone they've spoken to, like a teacher, that they couldn't play music. So they never really tried.
Yeah.
You know, they saw it as this, I'm not naturally talented, you know, so they've just counted themselves out.
Yeah.
And then they've realized that, you know, decades later, oh, actually, there's not really such a thing as talent. It's just, you just do it or you don't, you know?
Totally, yeah. If you've got a passion for something like music and you can't play a guitar, like everyone starts not being able to play a guitar.
Exactly.
You know? Not everyone gets born with a little Fender going, yeah, I'm mean.
Yeah.
Like, you have to start not being good at something.
Right.
And then it's up to you to get good at it, right?
Do you remember being crap at it, though?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because my memory's...
Still crap at it. You know, you're a guitar player. You're never going to master the art of playing guitar,
no,
right?
No, of course not.
You're always going to be able to go, I can't do that. That's amazing. I'll never be able to do that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, for loads of time, like, playing guitar is hard.
Mm.
It's not an easy instrument.
It is, but I don't remember it as being hard.
Really? Not even when you first started?
I remember not being good at it. Like, yeah. I remember finding things hard to do, but...
That's more what I mean. Like, yeah. it's a hard instrument to learn, I reckon.
There was a cassette of me and my friend Ben that I went to school. We both started playing around the same time. And we pressed record on this tape deck and recorded ourselves jamming.
Yeah.
And it was about probably a less than a year after we started playing. And we lost the cassette. And now I'd love to have that cassette, because my memory says that we were on.
Like, yeah, you were the best you've ever been.
We were the best, we had a fantastic groove, and you know, but I bet you would have sounded fucking horrible.
Do you remember those little wins you get as well, though, when you're like, you'd be jamming on a scale or trying to do something you've never done, and then all of a sudden you're like, yeah, fuck, I can't believe I've actually been practicing this for so long and now I can do it.
Yeah.
Like, whether it's just like a run that you've been practicing as a solo and you're absolutely so shit at it for like 6 months, then all of a sudden, boom, you lock in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the stuff I remember going when you go, I've taken another little step.
Or if I played something that seemed advanced or seemed interesting, but then I didn't understand why it worked.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I don't know what that is, but it sounded cool.
Yeah.
And then I'd spend the next 10 years trying to unpack it.
yeah. Sounds like life.
Yeah, pretty much does it. Yeah. So did you finish school and go to high school? I mean, go to university and all of that?
No. So I finished school and then basically, finished school and then went and worked at What Now, because I was working there part-time.
Yep.
So I just went straight to full-time work there in the art department.
How did that happen? Did you just apply for a job? Or
already working there, yeah. Same thing with my brother. He worked in the art department there.
Yeah.
And so he kind of did it every Saturday morning, it was back then, and then I just started going along. I was a cabler through school, which is just one of those kids that holds a cable behind a cameraman.
Oh, yeah.
But all of What Now back then, everyone was very young. Like, mm-hmm. the tally ops were like 12, 13. I was like 13, 14.
Really?
But it was just a tiny little crew of people.
literally tiny.
Yeah, they're tiny little humans.
Short and young, yeah.
And the whole thing was full of family, right? So the floor manager's kids were tally ops, and like, I got my job because my bro worked there, and he got his job because dad's mate knew someone who worked there, so right. It was this big family. So I did that for 2 years, and then we all got shifted to Wellington when What Now got shut down in Christchurch.
Right, yeah.
So, and that's when...
But that seems like a huge risk for the... You know, it's still a TV show that has to make money and, you know, financially add up and whatever, and it's run by kids.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, I guess the important...
I mean, it's not run by kids.
Yeah, jobs weren't run by kids, but they had a lot of, you know... But a lot of those people stayed on, you know, like...
Yeah.
You know, I was there for 13 years, and probably... There would have been at least four or five others who were there the same amount of time.
Right.
You know, just kind of going up the different levels into different jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, then we all moved to Wellington, and that's when, I guess, you know, I kind of got way more of a sense of what, you know, what a music scene was like. Because when we got to Wellington, that was your She-Hard, Fur Patrol, Weta days.
Like, yeah.
That was in 1999. So.
Weta, yeah, I remember them.
So we walked into this, like, being in a rock band, we walked into this environment going, whoa. This town is going off. Head Like a Hole, Weta, She-Hard, Fur Patrol. All these bands playing every weekend, these massive rock shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great. So we just kind of fell into that world for a while.
Brilliant. I think the Lawnmower Man has decided to turn up.
Good on him.
Today, which is awesome, because he'll be... Yeah, he'll be right outside the window in a second. So.
Is he coming to do your lawns?
Yeah, I think so. He does The Verge and then he comes in here. So we'll have to see how that goes.
All right. We'll just talk very loudly over
exactly,
it.
Yeah. And so how did you end up becoming Props Boy? That was the right name, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That was just a real classic thing of just annoying people and hanging out and hanging around. Now, it was actually, the reason it happened is that when What Now moved to Wellington, for the first time ever, they went and just from being a Saturday show, they went to doing it 5 days a week as well. So right. it became weekday, what now weekdays. Mm-hmm. So what now is on 6 days a week. And Shav was presenting that, and they just put her on by herself. So she was just hosting the show by herself.
Yeah.
And it was a bit rough, you know, because what now has always been about multiple presenters and interaction. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it was just her. And I think it was just a bit of a struggle. So we kind of talked about, well, how about I just start being like an on camera. It was just my hand. It started with just my arm.
Right.
And like, and I'd just pass props into her or pass stuff or.
Oh, and that's why you're called Props Boy. Yeah, oh, right. Yeah. Got it.
So she'd be like, Props Boy, pass me the cream pies and cream pie this kid. So she always had someone that wasn't on camera to, you know, just to be like a interact with.
Yeah.
But then eventually, yeah, it went from being my arm to actually going on camera and doing that stuff and wearing the crazy hat.
Where did the hat come from?
I actually don't know.
Right.
I don't know what it was. Yeah.
Someone else made that decision. Yep. Yeah.
Originally, it was just like a bucket hat, like a cricket hat with no visor that I'd pull down over my eyes.
Right.
So you couldn't see my face. I didn't want anyone to see my face because I was just like, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm like wearing no clothes and around children.
Right.
No one should see my face. This is dangerous. Because it was just bad. So but then eventually, I think after the first year, the wardrobe department, I think they just went scouting and found like those kind of sun visor things and started making their own.
That was my next question. Did the hat already exist as a thing or did they make it for you? So I guess you just answered that.
No, they made it.
Yeah, they did make it.
They made that one, yeah. But right. I think they got the designs from, you know, I think there's, you know, other hats that have had kind of visors built in.
Really? So that was actually a product that people bought?
I think so. They sold the Props Boy hat, so I know they sold those as things, yeah. And they sold heaps of them. But it's real. It is pretty funny to think back now. Like, there's no way we could do what we're doing back then. Now,
no,
like, you know, we're pushing the boat out pretty hard with the stuff we're doing.
Yeah, which is sort of a shame in a way.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Because yeah. There's something wonderful. I mean, when I was a kid, of course, it was much earlier than when you were on What Now.
Yeah.
So I remember. Who were the hosts? I remember Simon.
Oh, yep. Simon and Kath, yeah.
Simon and Kath, that's right. Yeah. And who was the other? He's a radio DJ now.
Danny Watson?
Danny Watson, yeah. Which, of course, my name as well, so that was exciting.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So do all the presenters have a relationship with each other? Is there some sort of What Now family where everyone knows each other?
Like, yeah, I like Jace Farfoy is still one of my best mates. Mm-hmm. And obviously he's good mates with Bobby and all of those fellas. And so last week Jace brought Ant round to my office to see me. I haven't seen Anthony in like probably 5 years.
Yep.
Maybe longer. So me, Ant, Jace, Shav and Caro still all keep in touch. Yep.
Cool. Did you get to know the previous presenters from
Not really. I knew Fiona and Aaron.
Yep.
Fiona Anderson.
Not sure if I remember them.
Yeah, so they were on for like, Fiona was on for about 5 years.
Yep.
But they were the presenters that I worked on the show as like a cabler.
Right,
so I was just like in like star heaven.
Yeah.
You know, turning up every week as like a 13-year-old when you watch the show and then all of a sudden you're like in the studio.
Because we all watched the show growing up, right? I mean,
totally.
Every Saturday morning.
100%,
it was the whole thing.
I remember losing my shit like the first year I was there. I just couldn't believe it. I was nearly crying as a small child.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like sitting on the set and, you know, just being like, this is fucked.
I would love them to replay the very, very first episodes. Because I kind of vaguely, like, I don't actually know when What Now started. But
it was like 1982 or something. Steve Parr.
Steve Parr?
Steve Parr was the first presenter, yeah.
Right, was really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. For some reason, I got a real good knowledge of that show. I don't know what it is. It's like deep down.
Well, you were there for a while.
I know. It's deep down in my brain, I know so much about it where I know so little about other things.
Right. maybe it's an archiving space thing.
Yeah, it's just. Yeah.
What you can retain.
It was half of my life for a long time. You know?
But I do have a very vague recollection of the early version of the show. I must have been a toddler, you know.
Yeah.
I remember it being pretty pretty basic and pretty plain looking. Am I remembering that right, or am I creating that memory?
No, it was very very simplistic version of what it is now, for sure. Yeah.
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 And then it went crazy.
And it did go crazy. Now it's great, like I remember watching it last year when they had those sets and like, I was like, man, this is, and I remember working on that show, cleaning up stuff because I was props boy.
Yeah.
This is a funny thing. It's like, I was props boy on screen, but I was also props guy off screen.
Right.
So I'd walk in and like gunge people and cover them in cream pies and stuff. And then the cameras would cut and I'd have to clean it up. like that was my job.
Did that ever make you hesitate? Like maybe I won't send the gunge that way.
Nah, it was really weird. It was, because I never was just a presenter. I never was on a presenter's. I couldn't like just be like, la-di-da, show up. Like, yeah. I'd literally show up at 4:30 in the morning, get the entire show props ready, like everything ready to go for the show, and then go and do the show.
Right.
Do you want to stop while this guy's going, or is he all right?
I mean, it's going to become, I guess, a feature of the episode, isn't it?
That there is the sound of a guy weed-whacking outside.
It's just an uncanny timing that lawnmower people have.
Yeah. Oh, anytime you go outside, push roll on a camera. Exactly.
But this is the nature of the show. We're not in a soundproof studio. You know, we've had helicopters and, you know, all sorts of things happening. So I guess it's just the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
My next the thing I was going to ask a second ago was, what is the gunj made of? Is that a secret recipe?
Yeah,
or?
It's totally secret. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I can say legitimately that I was there and a part of it when gunj was invented.
Really?
That's how old I am. Yeah. Yeah. My props master, that's what we called him back in the day.
Yeah.
He came up with that mixture, and I remember seeing them go through so many different things to see what could work.
Did they use different versions on the show, or did they test them off
nah,
the show?
Nah, I think the one that's there now, I don't even know if the one that there is now is the same. I'm sure it is the same thing.
Yeah.
Because it was for so many years. But it's pretty basic. Like, I'm sure you could find it out if you wanted.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say it. I swore to my props boy inner self that I would never release a recipe.
Your inner contract.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So at the same time, you were out still playing in bands while you were doing that?
Yep, 100%, yeah.
Yep. Because I remember seeing Stereo Bus live.
Oh, yep.
In, I don't even remember when that was. Was that early 2000s?
Early 2000s,
yeah. And I remember being really surprised to see Farfoy in the band.
Oh, yeah,
because
yeah.
I was like, but that's the guy on TV. Like, I hadn't quite realised yet that people could do more than one thing.
I know. That is so strange. And I got that lots when we were touring around. Is like, you know, people knew me for being in that band and being on What Now? And it was always very buzzy.
Yeah.
Because it's also very strange when people look at you and they don't know what you look like.
Right.
So they're aware that you've done that on TV. Like, you are that character, but I have no idea what your face is. So people stare at you and you're like, really?
So because people wouldn't recognize you, right? Because
you're
always covered. So is it just
people like recognize my lips or something?
Really?
You know? Yeah, and my teeth.
Or they just look at you not knowing why they're looking at you, like not knowing why they recognize you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but because it's like when you see a famous person in real life, you just generally stare at them because you're like, it's quite strange that they're in front of you.
Yeah.
But I guess for me, it was like people like would stare at me going, I've never seen this person's face and it's really buzzing me out right now.
Look, for some reason, I'm familiar with his chin.
Yeah, yeah. I recognize your funny walk and your chin and your lips. I'm like, leave me alone.
And so did you bounce around lots of different bands before AutoZam happened?
No. I was just a one band man.
Right.
Yeah. Didn't really have time, to be honest. Like between work and doing that, it was pretty full on all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, because we were pretty committed to that whole thing for a long time. It was always funny, I remember when Nick was like, oh, I'm gonna go and have a jam with some other people, you'd be like, oh, what do you mean?
I can remember that dynamic too.
I thought we were going out, you know?
yeah,
it's like,
that memory doesn't make any sense to me now, but I remember that kind of feeling too. I think I was in a band for a while and I went to audition for something and I got the gig as well.
Right.
And I remember my drummer being really weird about it. And I thought, like, we're not dating, you know?
I know.
But it sort of felt like you were because you kind of banded together,
you know? Well, yeah, and you don't want anything to split apart what you've got going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, like thinking about it now, it feels stupid. It's like,
it seems insane now. We're all playing with lots of different people.
Exactly, 100%. The whole, you know?
Yeah. But I guess it's part of the experience of being a young person in a band. It's much more than the music. It's a. It is sort of a gang.
It's a band for a reason. It's, you're a band of mates.
Yeah.
You're not doing it for any other reason when you begin other than for yourselves.
Right. Yeah.
I've always said with a band, like, if you play music and you're having a good time doing it, that's the best thing.
Yeah.
But if other people like it, then that's just the icing on the cake.
That's right.
Like, if someone actually likes what you're making inside that room.
Yeah.
Then, that is kind of unheard of, you know. That's the rarity of being in a band.
Exactly.
Lots of people spend time together in a room making tunes, and they love it. Drinking beers, talking shit.
Yeah.
Having band practice is one of my favorite things in the world.
Right.
I used to love it because we just drink beers and talk shit. And then you'd
and maybe play a bit.
Maybe play the same song you've been playing for 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Should practice that one again.
Yeah. That's another memory I look back on now and think that seems mad, is having, we would have, you know, every Monday night booked or whatever, or every the day would change, but we would have the same songs and just play them every week. And
yeah.
now I almost never rehearse.
Yeah, you know,
there might be one rehearsal because we've got to add a bunch of new songs or something. But
yeah.
Usually you run new songs at soundcheck, so you just never really rehearse. So
yeah.
now it seems like it would be horrible, you know?
Like I used to hate band practice as much as I'd love it.
Yeah.
Because I'd hate band practice when it became work.
Yeah.
When you're like, we're only doing this because we need to do it because we're a bit shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you're playing lots of shows, you just get into a groove of playing shows, right? So
right.
you practice, but if you got big in between times, you know, you'd have to go along and just run over the same old song. So yeah, I used to just actually enjoy just, like you say, going to band practice and playing yeah. a little bit. But
and hanging out. Yeah, you know? Yeah. It would really annoy me when you're rehearsing just for the sake of certain musicians that just wouldn't learn their shit or remember things,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
That used to get me wound up a bit.
But what about you? The other thing I always laughed at, we're looking at back now, is you go, you know, you go on a tour, you're going to travel around the country, sweet as, you're going to do all of these rehearsals, but you're literally doing all of this work for what is potentially 40 minutes on stage in front of no one.
Exactly.
You know? So you band practice like 4 days a week, and you go to a plane or you get in a car and you drive for 15 hours, and there's not a problem with that.
No.
Like, you love it. Every minute of it, you're like, this is great, we're having a good time, and then you do a gig to no one, and you're like, you think, fuck, that was a lot of work for 40 minutes.
Yeah, I still think about that now.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that very thing a few weeks ago. We played in Blenheim. We flew down the day before, and we flew back the day after, and I was thinking about how that's basically 3 days. You know, there's all of this stuff to organize with transporting gear and, and some gear hired locally and all that kind of stuff. This whole thing that goes into it, and the money you end up making at the end of it, which now isn't terrible, but it still doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, you still love that journey though. Like I still love that part of it.
Well, the way that I look at it is to end it and to never do it again would be miserable.
Yeah.
What would you do? You'd just be sitting at home thinking, man, I wish I was out playing a show again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. The things you do, eh?
Yeah. So when did you meet the AutoZam guys then? Did you meet them all at once or?
No, I met Nick. He worked at the Rock Shop.
Yeah.
In
Christchurch?
Wellington.
Wellington, okay.
Yeah, AutoZam started in Wellington.
Right.
So yeah, Nick at the Rock Shop and then Ben and Craig. So Craig was in a band called 1QA, who I managed for a while. They were in Rock West. So the 1QA guys now are in a band called Miami Horror.
Yeah.
Out of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
With the bass player from Beach Dupa. I can't remember his name.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, we've got Craig, their drummer, and Ben, bass player, who played in a band called The Offbeats, which is like a ska band.
Cool.
And we just started from there. And that's probably like our first album was with them. And then that's when the rotating members began.
Right. You know? Oh, has there been a few?
Oh, there's heaps. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a bit confused when I was looking it up.
Yeah.
I was like, I know Jasper and Dan were involved.
Yeah.
And Stephen Small.
Yeah.
But I don't know if their names are on the Wikipedia page. Stephen's is, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But we mainly had more bass players than anything. Like, bass players came and went pretty quick. We had Ollie for a long time. But bass players and drummers, you know, it was always me and Nick. And then I think, you know, the final me, Nick, Ollie, Jasper and Steve did one album.
Yeah.
And then we replaced Jasper with Richard, who did the next album. So,
yeah.
Like, the last kind of 7 or 8 years is pretty consistent.
Right.
But the start was like, fuck yeah, we're fanging through people. Eh?
In fairness, though, that is pretty normal for bands.
Yeah.
I was going to say New Zealand bands, so it's pretty normal anywhere, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we lost two members when we moved to Auckland. Like, they didn't want to move. So,
exactly.
That's straight away.
Yeah.
You know?
And musicians are weird creatures as well.
Totally. You know, most bizarre humans in the world.
You think it would be quite a simple thing. You know, you get together and you make music and it should be simple, but it's always complicated somehow, whether it's financial or it's opinions about...
Yeah, and it's also just the anxiety of being a musician.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Exactly.
Everyone's on the edge all the time.
That's right.
No one's real calm about it. It's like everyone's on the edge for whatever reason it is.
Yeah.
You know?
And so what was the progression with AutoZam? Like, how did you go from being yet another band starting out to becoming a well-known band? Like, was there a break or was there a person that was the key, you know?
No, I think we just played lots of shows. Like, we just were in a van the whole time. At the very beginning, we just drove around and drove around and drove around. I don't know. I don't think you can ever put it down to one thing. And I don't think we became a well-known band by any means. I think we just were around like long enough that people knew our name.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I kind of figure if I've heard of you, then you're well-known.
Right.
Because I seem to live in my own world a little bit.
Sure.
So, especially these days.
I reckon, like, Well, yeah. I think there's things that have changed now that back then were really handy. So
yeah.
we were around when Channel Z was around. Mm-hmm. So Channel Z was a massive plug for local rock music, you know, punk, like, you know, Goodnight Nurse,
yep.
Bleeders, you know, all of these bands that were getting no commercial radio play,
right.
all of a sudden were all over radio, and then people were coming to your shows.
Yeah.
And that was a massive shift for lots of bands, I think, going from playing to like 100 people to playing to like 500 people.
Right.
Yeah. And everyone used to play together as well.
Mm.
So you put on a mean lineup
yeah.
of like 6 or 7 bands.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone's crowds got to see everyone. So then you just, you build a fan base like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think Channel Z, Juice TV, amazing, you know, wanted to play local music videos no matter how good or bad they were.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, having things like the Juice Awards, and then there were the Music Video Awards back then. So there was just all these different little ways to get your band out there.
Yeah.
That you could use, you know, to sell yourself to, like, a big day out. Like, if you're gonna, you know, back then, if you're like, well, we've got a song on Channel Z, and we've got music video being played, and, you know, we've played these supports, international supports.
Yeah.
Then that all goes into, like, the little bio, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that makes it easier to sell your band to do the next step.
It builds it up, yeah.
Yeah. But that, this is when there was a real striving rock scene around as well.
Mm.
So there was so many rock bands, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I really like, one thing I really liked in the 90s is that you could put out like a budget music video, but more artistic, which was, I don't know, that would go alongside high production videos. And I know you work in videos.
Mm.
But there was something great about Pearl Jam releasing videos of just surfers. Just stock footage,
it's totally. Like whatever, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And those early like Head Like a Hole videos and stuff, they were really raw. But that painted the picture of the band. I feel like these days everyone's expected to try and compete at a really hi-fi level.
Yeah.
But the money's not there usually to compete at that level, so it's throwing the industry out of whack a bit. It's hard to be a band starting out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the keys that I think is important now to do that, which, whether it's right or wrong, is that, like you're saying with Head Like a Hole, is you need to give your band an identity that is true and not false.
Not forced, yeah.
So, you know, there's no point putting the Head Like a Hole guys in a in a beautifully shot music video by a waterfall.
Right.
Because, you know, that's not, you know, but I think a lot of bands have done that, and us included, where it's like, man, we should have just been ourselves more and portrayed yourself more, and you probably would relate to people more.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to be a polished up version of something that's not polished up, if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense. I also think, though, it's probably a life lesson that that in general anyway,
yeah.
you know, especially when you're about our age and you look back and you go, oh man, you know, like all those times where I was trying too hard, I should have just relaxed and just
totally
sort of let it happen, you know?
Yeah, and you do, the older you get, you know, you take these small steps and looking back and going, man, I made some stupid mistakes, but those stupid mistakes are exactly what has made me who I am now.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think it's really, you know, you've got to put an identity to the music you play, and because it's so hard to be seen now, right?
Yeah.
It's literally impossible.
It's crazy.
So to be relatable, you kind of, you know, you need to be relatable by finding out who your fan base is and appealing to them.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to appeal it to everyone all of the time. And I feel like we did that as Autozammed, probably too much of, like, shifting genre. Like, one out, like, all three albums sound completely different, but it's the same band.
Yeah.
You know, so we were trying to find a niche of what we should be doing, you know.
Like, trying to appease the industry to get
more play. Well, not the industry, but, not even that. It's just more like, it's like going, well, you know, sometimes when something doesn't work, you think you need to change it.
Yeah.
So you go, well, that album didn't really do any well. I love that record. Okay, let's try doing a real piano-heavy album.
Mm.
Not because we're trying to make something for other people, but it's like we're just trying to do something different as well.
But I think I see that as a good thing.
Yeah, but it's also very... it's a tough one because I look at those three records we made, and I probably love the first one the most.
Right.
Because it's the most rawest and exactly what we were.
Yeah.
Where the next two, like, it's still really great, and I love parts of them, but there's also parts where you go, what were we doing?
Yeah.
And why were we doing it? I don't have the answer to why we were doing it.
Right. Know? Yeah. I mean, I think it's a hotly debated issue with lots of bands, isn't it? Do you just do the thing you do?
Yeah.
Or do you evolve? You know, and I tend to be a fan of bands that keep evolving.
Yeah.
You know, and I think like the greatest template for that is the Beatles. I mean, look what they covered in 7 years.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I get bored with bands who, especially some of the big rock bands that, you know, they've been going now for decades and they keep putting the same thing out.
Yeah.
And it's like, whatever, just, you know.
Yeah, and I see what you mean with evolving, but it's also making sure you're evolving the right way and not, like, trying to, you know. I guess also evolving in the public space is a tough thing where you're like, okay, we've done this, but did we do it? Should we have done it internally rather than externally and going,
right,
we made a record. And then be like, wow, we probably should have thought about that more or spent a year touring those songs. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know.
I guess it comes down to the reasons why you evolve too, whether it's based in insecurity or, you know, are your intentions an artistic pursuit, you know, or are your intentions some other thing, some other agenda to try and, you know.
And, you know, you've been in plenty of bands. Yeah. When you're in a band, you're in a bubble, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So no perspective on it.
No perspective, yeah. So, you know, I've always said everything you do as a musician is a punt.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Every step you take is a punt. Like, no one knows whether you're going to step through the ice or you're going to, like, it's a punt.
Yeah.
Sometimes you win those punts and, you know, most of the time you don't.
Right, yeah.
So you're in a little bubble. And yeah, if you can get through to the other side and you've made some good decisions, then you've done well.
And that's what I was going to say before about making mistakes, or when you look back and you think, "What the hell did I do that for?" I guess I'm trying to take a more philosophical view these days on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, if you leave the house and try and do something in the world, you're going to fuck up. You know, it's just the nature of doing something. You know, the only alternative is to not do anything, and that to me is not a life I want. You know.
Yeah.
So
that's very deep.
It is deep, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's too early in the day to get that deep.
It's because we're like middle aged. Well, I'm middle aged now.
Thanks for not associating me in that.
So in 10 years, I'll probably regret this chat.
Right.
Because I will be older and more in depth in my visions of what we're now talking.
Well, maybe
about.
We get back together in 10 years.
Yeah, let's do it. Should we stop now and come back?
Do a review. Yeah. We'll make sure the lawnmower guy's here as well.
Yeah. By the age of him, he looks like he'll be dead.
And so the other career you've got in the background with the video work and the colouring and that sort of thing, how did that all, did that sort of originate with what now somehow?
Yeah, or? So I've just been doing film and telly for like 25 years pretty much.
Yeah.
So what now is just kind of learnt all of the... You learn heaps there, like they get you to direct or edit, you know, because they just give you a hoon at everything.
Yeah.
And then coming out of that, I just went freelance as a director.
Right.
And editor back then.
Yep.
And then just did loads of commercials, and then I spent 10 years at C4.
Yeah.
Not as an employee, but I did, you know, I did all of Die Henwood's insert video here.
Oh, yeah.
Made that entire series and then Roll the Die. So made lots of TV shows through there, lots of comedy. I guess I've kind of... done a lot of comedy work, like comedy directing.
Uh-huh.
And then got into the commercial world, made a bunch of ads, which kind of, you know, was great for a while, but it becomes quite draining doing commercial work. And now, the last kind of 5 years, just becoming a pretty much full-time colorist.
So how did you learn how to actually run the business? Did you always have a sense for that?
Yeah, I think actually, like, managing a band, like when we first started, managing a band and organizing tours and releases and stuff, like, puts you in quite a good mind frame for running a business.
Yep.
Like, well, especially in a TV business, because it's very similar.
Mm.
You know, it's all about schedules and timings and delivery. Like, all of those things are real similar. So I guess, working on it with the band on a daily basis and also organizing people, you know what it's like to organize a band. Yeah. Like, there is definitely a hierarchy of the most shit person to the best person when it comes to being somewhere or doing something on time.
Yeah, totally true.
No one is on the same level.
Yeah.
So same with like film shoots, like you're organizing, you know, from DOPs, art department, all that stuff. It's all, you know, so I think I've always had that kind of management style of running everything that I do.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So Commotion, our production company, there's two of us. So Warren, who's a DOP, and me, who's director in that. And we just basically now we'll just go out and try, you know, like any production company, try and get the jobs.
Yep.
Pitch for jobs that everyone's pitching for.
And I hear it's going well. Mutual friends, it's doing good. You know.
As a colorist, it's going well. Like, the production company stuff have kind of eased off a bit because the freelance, like, variety, spice of life, right?
Yeah.
So being a colorist, it means pretty much every day I'm doing something different, whether it's a bit of content or a music video, a short film, an ad. But when you're running a production company, and when we made like the RockQuest TV show, for instance, we did 6 years of that.
Yeah.
It's great. It's amazing, but it's kind of 5 months of your life on the one thing.
Right.
And that can become hard, I reckon.
Yeah, I can understand that.
So I way prefer being a freelancer and just getting, you know, and being a colorist, it's like mastering. It's like people bring you this final product, which is beautiful, and they just like make it more beautiful.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is great.
It's a misunderstood craft, isn't it, mastering?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
We just, yep. I just had something mastered with Chris Chetland, and he did an amazing job.
Oh, bro, he's awesome.
Yeah. And but I still don't quite know what he did. You know, I don't actually know. I mean, and I sometimes wonder, did he just do something that took like 3 minutes and then charge me loads of money?
Yeah.
Well, but even if he did, it's still good.
That's the key. He'll never tell you what he did because you could literally, no, you couldn't actually. Chris is amazing.
Yeah, he is amazing.
But yeah, it's the same. It's when people come in for a grade, like there's plenty of people who come in and will sit down and they won't know really what's about to happen sometimes, especially if you've got, you know, like agency type or client types of coming into a grade and they're like, we know that it looks better after a grade, but they've got no idea what you've gone and done.
Right. Yeah.
So I prefer that at the moment. Yep. Production world has always been there for me. It's always been a part of my life.
Yep.
It's real funny. I've always sort of like, my production and TV, life as a great hobby that pays for my love of music. You know,
that's a good way.
It's not the other way around. You know?
Yeah.
So now it's good. I'm enjoying doing that, and I still enjoy doing loads of music videos and all of that stuff.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
Well, we should talk about LA because I remember first hearing. When did I first hear them? I can't even remember when I first heard them, but I remember first hearing Alex sing and thinking, "Holy shit! Like, what a seriously good singer." And
he's got some lungs on him.
Yeah, but I believe you first heard them at Rockquest, right?
Yep. Yeah, we were making the Rockquest show in 2012, I think they won.
Mm.
And yeah, so we got to go and the 12 national finalists back then, we got to go and make like a little 6-minute doco on each band.
Yep.
So yeah, I got put with those boys in Nelson and we spent like 3 days together. And yeah, when I heard him sing, I was like, there's only been two people in my life that through the whole Rockquest thing that I've heard sing, which I went, holy shit, you're amazing. And one was Georgia from Broods when she was like 14 and went in a little church down in Nelson. And her and her cousin sang the song. I was like, fuck, who is this? and then it was Alex like a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And I just heard it like, because we'd go and film little doco pieces and be like, we'd turn up and just be like, oh, just, all right, so just sing us a song, you know, we'll set up for a little acoustic performance. And he sang and I was like, holy shit. How old are you? He's like, 16. It's like, man. You sound like a 70-year-old blues man.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be one of my questions, is all of the bands that you must have come across over the years, you know, what was the thing that made you decide to get involved with them? Was that the main thing?
Yeah, it was just, him and Alistair as well. I was just like, there's something there. And I never wanted to manage a band. Like, I'd finished, like, Autism had finished, and I was doing film and telly, and I was loving life. And then he came along. Those two came along and I was just like, yeah. And then once they won Rockquest and then they went their separate ways.
Right.
Alex moved to Melbourne and I think Alistair went to jazz school in Wellie, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Alex got back, I just saw him on Facebook and I just said to him, oh, if you ever need help with your music, you know, give us a bell.
Yeah.
And you'll see what we can do. Because there's always been frustrating that gap between leaving school like band one Rockquest and then like that next step has always been like this dark hole of like, you think you're awesome because you won that, but the reality is like it's you've only dipped your toe into what is a pretty ugly place to go.
That's right.
You know, trying to make it as a musician.
Yep.
So we just wanted to give him a hand up, and so yeah, basically he came and he sent me a bunch of demos, like probably about 30 songs.
Yep.
He recorded on his phone while he was traveling, and I was like, yeah man, let's do this. And then he was like, I'd love to get Alistair involved. And then Alistair basically called me up and said, should I move to Auckland? And I was like, I reckon you should move to Auckland because there's something here.
Yep.
Just come up, just go at it slow, do some recordings, we'll put up some cash, do a couple of roundhead sessions. And the first song they ever recorded was All Gived Up, which within probably a month of Alistair being here. Just went into roundhead and they did that. And that's still my favorite song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I definitely, you know, I didn't want to, like I said, I didn't want to manage bands.
Well, I was going to ask, because when I first heard that you were managing them, once I'd met Jaden, I remember thinking, why the fuck would you want to do that? Like, surely, I mean, you've been through AutoZam and all of that, you know, you know better than anyone how tough it is to be a manager.
Well, the good thing with LA is that they're way better than AutoZam. So it makes it way easier to manage.
Right.
You know, because I know that I can put that band in a room of most people and you know, they'll some, they will reach out. Alex will reach out and he'll grab, you know, he gives you the feels, he'll grab your heart. And every word he sings, he believes. And that's, you know, if you're in a room of that and you don't feel it, then you're quite soulless, you know.
Right.
Because he does, like he reaches into you. Well, he does for me personally, and that's why I do it, is because I believe there's something real special there.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard a voice like it, and, you know, lyrics and songwriting. And I think them as a band now has just come, you know, with Marika joining and Jaden. I think the next step of songs are going to be real impressive.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. They're great musicians.
Yeah, because that first album was literally like, you know, a lot of songs written as a two-piece with the band added. So now they're going to write as a four-piece. I think it's going to be like real good.
And so when, you know, again, when I first heard that you were managing them, I thought that seems really strange to me.
Yeah.
But
and me.
As it's unfolded, it's been really impressive to see a lot of the stuff you've done with them and the way that you've promoted them and pushed them. Do you have, I mean, is it still at this point, and I don't mean this in a derivative way, but is it sort of a hobby, or is it that kind of for fun? Because it seems to me like you've got a very clear plan happening.
Yeah, it's definitely not a hobby. Yeah. Like it's a full-time gig when it's busy. Like, you know, I will go into work in my office, you know, probably at least 2 days a week at the moment, and those 2 days will be devoted to what we're trying to achieve and what we're doing next. Where, like, you know, maybe 2 years ago, it was definitely more of a, you know, just feeling it out, see what's going on. But yeah, I think you have to have a plan. You have to have a real solid plan of what you want the band to achieve, because you're always going to set a goal, right? And the goal this year was, we're going to release a record.
Right.
Okay, so what do we need to do to release a record to be successful as, in New Zealand, a band that plays 4.5 minute love songs? It ain't easy, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not playing 3 minute club bangers.
And the other question, of course, is what is successful?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially these days.
Well, I think successful to me is reaching a fan base of people that you know will enjoy that music.
Right.
Like, how do you reach out to the maybe 1,000 people that you know love Wilco and love Josh Rouse and love, like, that you think will love this band? Like, how do I get this band to them?
Yeah.
Like, that is, and if you can do that, then I think that's a win, because that's the toughest thing, right? In the world of oversaturated music and content and all of that stuff, it's like, I don't care how many records you sell or really how many people come to the show and all that stuff. It's more about going, let's make sure that what you're doing that I believe in is reaching the right people.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you do that? Well, for us, it was about creating loads of video content. Like, that was kind of one of our original plans. Like, if we can just, let's just film you guys singing a song and put it online and see who shares it, and see, like, and people are like, blah, 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 you'll love this. And then blah, 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 you'll like this.
Yeah.
And that's how we slowly built a fan base. And we've probably done over 30 videos for those guys.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
From live to music videos.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be flash. Like, it's literally, you know, Alistair knows how to, you know, set up and record, you know, into his laptop, and I just put a camera up. And there's lots of early videos where it's literally that. It's just one camera and them singing to camera.
Right.
And then you just put that out there. And I think that was our kind of original goal, is to build a little fan base that way.
And was part of that to release something that was organic and believable?
Yeah. Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah. And I think,
because with that band, you can do that. You can just stick a mic on them.
Yeah, you can just show, like, raw talent. And and that's what I was saying earlier about putting a face to the music. Like, what you see with Alex singing, and what you see and what you get is exactly what you.
That's right.
You know, it's not fake.
Yeah.
Like, he ain't putting it on.
Yeah.
Like, he's disappeared into that song.
Absolutely.
Every time, I've never not once seen him, like, disappear into a song.
Yeah.
Even still, you know, now I'm playing way more shows.
Oh, so there's a lot of depth in that guy, eh? There's a lot to him.
There's a lot to him, and there's a lot more to come. You know, and he's. Yeah. You know, I've loved watching both him and Alistair grow up in the last kind of... It's only been 3 years since I've started working with Alex, and 2 years since Alistair. Mm. But yeah, I think as long as you've got a goal, like a goal of, okay, what do we want to do next?
Right.
And, like, the album was a big one for this year.
Yeah.
So we all worked really hard to, you know, I have a lot of respect for what labels do now after doing that independently, eh?
Yeah. I mean, you guys have not only put all the effort in, but you've also put money in. And do you expect that to come back? Like, are you looking at a financial resolve as well?
Yeah, but that's also part of the plan, right? It's like, as long as you're open and upfront with your artist about going, you know, I'm going to have to invest $5,000 into this.
Yeah.
But then your job as the manager is to go out and get that $5,000
and earn it, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
from shows. But you know, if you do a, yeah, so you got a record to put out, we need to put some money into the record to make sure people can hear it,
right?
And if we do a good enough job with that, that means that shows will happen,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
if we get some radio play, shows will happen. So it's your job to make sure that you're putting the money in, but you're going to get that money back by making sure you've done a good job with that money.
Yeah.
So now, like, yeah, so we put the album out and they've got a bunch of shows over summer, like a whole bunch of, you know, they're okay kind of paying shows, mm-hmm, and that'll recoup that money real quick.
Right, okay.
And as long as you're upfront with the artist, is going, you know, your next five shows, you're probably not going to earn any money.
Yeah.
You know, because we need to recoup on, and we're not talking heaps of money, it's just a few grand here and there.
Mm.
And, you know, as long as everyone's aware of that, then it's fine, you know. But it's when you put in fucking heaps of money and then you go, oh, I've got no way of earning any of that back.
Right.
Like, you just got to make sure,
yeah,
you got to be smart about whether it's streaming or, you know, just making, like, merch, all these things. Like, you can, you can earn money if you're smart about it.
Did you have good conversations in AutoZam about money? With each other?
Yep. We did. But we were like most bands, we were just constantly in debt, right? So
there was never
any money to be made. Like I said, you had to put in money for those albums. So, yeah.
And musicians are often really uncomfortable talking about money.
Yeah.
They see it almost sometimes as a sellout or as a, you know, they jump to insist that they're not doing it for the money. And it's like, well, that doesn't change the fact that we still have to buy petrol to get to the gig. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a pragmatic side of it.
Money, you know, is just a, you know, everyone needs it to do everything.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
So
it doesn't speak to your intentions.
I can't really remember having like open chats about it, but I know that we're always on top of it because you always need a really good lawyer and a really good accountant,
yeah,
in life,
mm-hmm,
and a good manager. And if you've got those three things down, then you should be sweet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your lawyer will tell you what you should be doing, your accountant will tell you what you should spend your money on, and then it's your job to make sure that,
right,
you know. So I always run most things last going, should we spend this $2,000 on a poster run? Like, you know, and, you know, all those kind of questions that you need to go, am I going to earn $2,000 back by doing that? So, but this has all come from years of experience of fucking that up as well. It's like, yeah, spending way too much money on stuff you don't need to.
Yeah.
And so having a direct plan of, a plan of attack, I think, is uber important, especially for a band like them where it is, you know, they're not going to be a number one on the edge, you know.
Well, not, I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
We don't know yet.
Well, if they do something, then something's bizarre has happened in the world.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I think one of the downsides of the music industry is that the culture of the industry makes business and money almost seem like the opposite or like the enemy or something.
Mm.
And so when a lot of people starting out in the industry are trying to find their way and navigate their way, they don't really know where to get good advice and they don't get good advice. And
yeah,
it's funny how the same, like, every generation seems to make the same mistake over and over again. It's been going on since the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, these guys in LA are profoundly lucky to have you working with them.
Oh, that's lovely.
No, and I don't mean that to blow smoke up your ass. I just mean that even if you, I mean, we're all human, none of us get everything right, but just to have that experience and that guidance is just something most bands don't get to have.
Yeah, and it is a funny one because, like, I definitely have a real passion for that band. So, because people ask me who else you're managing, and I just laugh. Like, one is enough.
Would you ever consider managing?
I would consider, like, but I need to be real passionate about what they're doing. As soon as that passion is not there, then that's when you need to have a real frank conversation about going, we're not doing this for the right reasons anymore.
Yeah.
But I still, you know, I would, you know, I definitely, if someone came along and blew my mind like Alex has done,
yeah,
then there's just a part of me that you wouldn't be able to stop.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
It's still in there. There's still a real passion for music and a passion for sharing music with people. And that's the thing that's my main goal with this band, with LA, is that I know they need to be heard.
Yeah.
And that is the toughest thing to do. Like, recording music and videos and all of that stuff is actually, for me, quite a straightforward process.
Yeah.
But getting them seen and heard is the toughest thing.
It's the holy grail these days, isn't it?
Exactly.
Doesn't matter,
you know,
who it is. So, I mean, there are major international artists that release, you know, great albums that never get heard.
Exactly.
Just comes out at the wrong time or doesn't have the same machine behind it.
And I'm not expecting that I need to hear, like, I don't expect to hear all the greatest albums in the world, but I would love it if someone somehow got me a great rock album that I hadn't heard yet, because I love rock music.
Yeah.
So it's that thing of going, how do I break through all of this smoke and haze to get what I think is an amazing band heard by their audience that don't know they exist yet.
Right, yeah.
That's the simple goal for me. You know?
I heard from the guys that there'd been a couple of offers from record companies and you'd turn them down. And firstly, is that true? And what's the reason for that? And thirdly, I agree with the decision.
Yeah. So, definitely, like, we've had quite a few offers from publishers overseas.
Right.
And publishers there. And there's been a couple of smaller record labels in America. Like, people always approach you, because we've had a couple of Spotify New Music Fridays US. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, like, track number 4. You know, it was like Eminem, Beyonce, blah, blah, and then it was LA, Two Strung Up, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then from that, like, we just got inundated with, I don't know, probably like 15 publishing offers from just little publishers from around the world.
Yeah.
Going, we love this song, we want to license it. And then you just, you know. And then the problem is you start spending heaps of money with your lawyer because you send them, like, these emails and go, what do you think? And and you're just like, fuck, we can't afford to actually keep doing this. So,
are they all asking for exclusive rights?
No. Some of them were.
Yeah.
Some are non-exclusive. There's all sorts of random little deals, you know,
right.
Like non-exclusive, get out of a 60-day, or we want to license the song exclusively for this region.
Yeah.
But no, we've just always been of the theory of just, you know, hold on for as long as you can.
Yeah.
The longer you hold, the better the outcome will be for you, which is the advice my lawyer, Chris Hockard, good man,
yep.
Very, very straight up, very honest.
Yeah.
He's basically just say no to everything until you can't.
Right, Do you see yourself one day being offered a deal that you accept?
Yeah, I think in the publishing world for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, totally.
Yeah, but not a standard record contract.
You know, unless it's a global one, but like, I think you can do... You can do New Zealand yourself for sure,
right?
If you've got a plan and know what you want to do. I mean, it's always going to help to have a record label for pushing songs to radio,
yeah.
And for doing the marketing. But I mean, the LA team is a big team of people now. It's probably about 20 people that work around the world.
Really?
On the band, yeah.
Wow.
So that's all independent, you know, and that's all paid for by the band, and you know. So again, going back to that plan, it's like, you know, we've got a publicist in America, and we have a publicist in Australia, and we have a radio plugger in Australia, and we have a college radio plugger in the US. But all of these people cost money, right?
Yeah.
They're not working for free.
Yeah, of course.
So, and that's, I guess, the good thing about when you've got a record label, right, is that those people come with the deal.
Yeah.
So they're going to, part of your deal is that these people work at the record labels, they get radio pluggers, publicists, PR.
But then how much do you give up because of the deal?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you could, you know, there's going to be pros and cons for both, right?
Yeah, got to weigh
it up. For LA, their music is super syncable,
mm.
And that just means, you know, it should be in movies, it should be on ads.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they've got plenty of songs where someone should be dying at the end of a movie and their song's playing, you know. You know? So publishing for me is, I really want to go down that track, and that'll be the first thing I think we sign, will be a publishing deal. And, you know, if it's with a big major, then that'll probably come with a record deal.
Yeah.
As well, but you know, just see what you get. There is no rush. Like, we did this record independently, and it's, you know, it's done really well for what, you know, we achieved everything we wanted.
Yeah.
So I always say, yeah, hold on until you can't hold on, I reckon.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good note to finish on.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
No worries, bro.
It's been great. It's been lots of fun.
Say hi to Bobby for me as well.
Will do.
Yeah. Thanks, bro.
Well, thank you, Mikey Carpenter, for that fantastic conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. And also thanks to our loyal followers and loyal listeners. And look, if you really enjoyed listening to this, give us a review on iTunes. Invite people to have a listen to it. Like the page on Facebook and all of that sort of guff. We really appreciate when people do that. So thanks for being engaged and helping us out.
Definitely. Alrighty, well, have yourselves a good time, and we'll see you on the next one.
Alright, I will. Bye.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share, and subscribe, and give us a review on iTunes.